Well, here we are again, and today we're in the big town of Albuquerque. The date is April the 15th. Oh, income tax day, right. 1997. And today we have the pleasure of talking to Max Forsythe, recently from the Tucson area, originally from the Indianapolis area. And so, Max, tell us a little bit about your life before square dancing, where you're born and brought up and so forth.
Well, I was born and brought up in Terre Haute, Indiana. When I went through high school, I was sort of a jock. I did athletics three times a year, so that pretty well kept me busy and kept me out of trouble. And then I went to Indiana State, and to finish the education thing, then I was in the service and came back and did my master's degree at Purdue University in industrial mycology and botany. And that's sort of a college. Then I did a few other 6 weeks courses and that kind of thing. Later on.
Well, then you got into teaching, right?
Yeah. When I came out of the service, well, I never wanted to do anything but teach. And I went from college into the service and then came back, and I knew it was a good time to get my master's degree, but I never really intended to do anything but teach high school biology or zoology or whatever they offered. And so that was what I wanted as a future, and it really is what I did, except for 13 years. And when I was a junior in college, I was I was interviewed by the chief naturalist of the Indiana State Park System. He came to the college, and I happened to be an assistant to the botany professor. And so anyone with that kind of seemingly reputation, at least in the department, he interviewed. And he hired me as a naturalist in 1941, and I went to McCormick's Creek State Park as a naturalist, and there were three of us there working, and sometimes the chief even came there to work with us. But in along about the 1st of April of that year, 1941, I went to one square dance. And it was in a local recreation hall, and it was really a house made over. But all I can remember is I couldn't understand the word that that jabber guy was saying up there. And thank goodness it was single couple progression kind of dancing where you could watch and pick it up and do it. But if I had never gone to another square dance, I would just have been as happy. But of course, all the time, I had a good bit of musical training. Why, it was interesting what we were doing and what it was the music. And if I remember right, it was all patter calls. I don't think there were any singing. And then when I took my naturalist job, I went in to go to work at this naturalist along about the 25th or 28th of May. And when I was there, I was in a park where we had a large hotel, again centered around nature kind of thing, and it was well attended, and they were full up every week with people who, back then, people didn't drive a long way for their vacations. They came in from Cincinnati and all that. And the chief naturalist, he sort of handled the first programs. Mm-hmm. And that I learned that on Sunday night there was going to be a lecture. And my buddies there could handle that because they'd done it years before. And then on Monday night there was a song fest, and the other two people that I was working with really couldn't sing at all, And so I was told that he would do the first song fest, and the next Monday night it would be mine. And then on Monday he told me, now tomorrow night there's a hayride out of the hotel. Now, we usually, I think they put 25 or 30 on a rack, and there were usually about four racks. So it was a big gang of people, and said, we're going out to Redbud Shelter House, and we serve everybody a dinner there from the hotel. And then afterwards, we square dance. And so we do some other play party games and all that. And said, I'd like for you to learn this one. I don't remember what it was for the life of me, but it was either a very simple singing call or patter. And he said, I'll take care of the dance, but I want you to do just this one.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the second dance I'd ever been to. I did one. He said, now just remember, next week you do the whole thing. So here we were, outside on a nice patio area outside the shelter house. We were always outside and unless it rained. And usually no fewer than six squares on the floor, up to maybe eight or ten, and we were really squeezed in. No amplifying system, out of doors, calling to that many squares. And what I did, I stood up on the little wall, and that's what he did, stood up on the wall, and to live music. Now, luckily, the live music was not amplified,
mm-hmm.
so I didn't have to battle that, but it was live music, and I don't criticize him, but the music, I remember we didn't have a fiddle. Oh, yes, we had a fiddle, and I think a banjo. Anyway, it was all sort of the tinny, high-pitched instruments. Well, I did that for the rest of the summer, once a week. And then I knew I had to learn more about square dancing. So come Saturday night, I would go anywhere that I found out there was a square dance in the area. And I'd drive over to another state park at Brown County and just get in and dance with them. And then we'd drive to Columbus, Indiana, and they had a good traditional square dance there. And so I visited lots of places. But anyway, that got me hooked, and I kept calling. And I did a lot of parties for churches and that kind of thing in the winter. And then when the war was over, the one thing I wanted to do was to get back into the naturalist service, so went to college full-time, and but with a summer season off so that I could work as a naturalist. And I worked for about 4 years, and again, I was the one who did all the calling. And along about the second year of that, let's say 1948, some of the guests at the hotel from Indianapolis said, they called me on the phone in the winter, and they said, we'd like to form a square dance club. And it was very interesting because these were very influential people. They had it at one of the nicest country clubs there, and these were people who were real estate people. They were younger, and there was only one couple that had had some experience square dancing in California, and so they sort of gave advice and that kind of thing. But I went over to call for them once a month or twice a month, I don't know which it was. And it was very interesting that I could do anything with them, and we were doing some of the little folk dances to put your little foot and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they incidentally called themselves, and I hear these very high class influential people, and they called themselves the Dirty Odor Club. Really, the D.O. Club, but it meant Dirty Odor. But, and they were real fun people. and I had just a great time with them. And then I began doing special parties for churches, and there was one Christmas party in about 1949 that I did, and again at a high class country club, put on by the leading realtor in town for his children and all of their friends, but primarily college age.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this dance, and it was just great, and had this live band, and this is a band that they were primarily a Hawaiian band, but they were good musicians, and they had me there, and this was between Christmas and New Year's, and so we had a marvelous party. And so after the dance, they said, "We're opening a dance hall on the south side, and it's going to be a nice kind of place. There'll be no drinking. As a matter of fact, the other fellow who was promoting it with him, who owned that hall, was a minister's son, and he was sure of what kind of a place he wanted to operate. And they said, "Why don't you come out and dance with us and just see what it's like? And just let's call one tip for the people who were there." Well, they had a radio show, so they were able to get out a lot of publicity that they were coming. And went out there, and I did, and then they had me come back and did it for about, I think, they had four dances. And then what they did, they called me and said, "We've decided that we're going to stop the ballroom and we're just going to make everything square dancing." Yeah, a very unusual situation. But this had the ballroom atmosphere of a low ceiling, and they put colored lights in it. And so we started having the square dance, and it was called Evergreen Terrace.
Okay.
And the within a month, we had so many people coming that they decided to tear out all the partitions and make it into one big hall, which they did. And they took the dormers and cut all they could out and made booths into the dormer windows and that kind of stuff. And we just started out like gangbusters. It was one of those dances where anyone could bring someone else and put them in the fourth couple position and get them dancing. And then our usual crowd was 300 plus.
Oh,
I think the most we ever had was 410, but we passed 400 a good many times.
Yeah.
And it was just a wonderful experience.
Sure.
And but again, for the first year, the single couple progression dances, and I didn't even know what a singing call was.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were doing all patter, and I had a good style for patter that made them feel like they were really dancing. And then the next, I think a year later, I remember it was in April, I heard about a rural youth square dance workshop in Ohio, and I tried to remember the men who were involved with it. Jerry Helt's the only one that I can recall, and Gus Heisman.
Oh, yeah.
Gus Heisman and Jerry Helt.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over to that. And a friend of mine, Paul Brading, caller from Indianapolis, went over too. And I can remember then I heard Red River Valley and Rose of San Antone and My Pretty Girl and a whole bunch of those things, Hurry, 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 a whole bunch of those things. And they just, to me, they just fit me to a T. So I brought those back and began introducing them a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Before that time, I had never called a ladies' chain. A ladies' chain was not in the traditional areas where I stole most of my material. No ladies' chain.
Is that right?
No. Which was very interesting.
Yeah.
There were areas of Indiana, and I can go over the areas of Indiana and what the square dancing was like. It was very different throughout this. And so then I came back and I began a slow and I slowly put that in, and then we began. The program went very well, and then Eli Lilly and Company contacted me and said, we'd like to have a dance on. No, this is about 2 years later, and the Hawaiian band had decided they didn't want to do it again, and I put together. Found a friend, and he put together a band in which we had a violin lead who also played piano, and he had studied to be a concert pianist, and he had played in a family country group all the time that he was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And he could really play the fiddle, and he played the fiddle on the hoedowns and played the piano on the singing calls. And I very soon decided I didn't like any melody behind me on singing calls. So we had a bass and a good rhythm guitar man and the piano. And that's the way we worked. And the band, everyone loved. They called themselves the Polka Dots. And everyone loved them. And we just had a great program. And another interesting story, and maybe this is all not too important, but our hall would hold exactly 29 squares. We had some posts in it, and by the time the main hall that we'd started with was 9 squares long and 2 squares wide, which was 18. And there was no other way to fit anyone else in. And then back in the back, there were 2 sections, one section that we had people sitting in, and 2 sections where you could dance. But we could get up to where we could dance 29 squares.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we always had more than 29 squares at the dance. So I started, you know, putting one group on the floor, and when we were finished, I'd say, next group. And they all wouldn't sit down. There'd be a lot of them, but enough would sit down that we could get the other group in there. And we usually did 4 tips, just running, okay, one after the other, and then we'd take a break.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd do 4 more tips, and the dances were always 9 to 12.
Yeah.
They were always late night. That was typical of that era.
Right.
And we, so that's the way we did. And then Eli Lilly and Company said, we'd like to have a special party on Friday night, first and third Fridays. So they had a good recreation department, and they rigged up this. And we went a year with Eli Lilly's, and we just had employees running out our ears, and we had a huge group. And the next year, they decided they wanted a second group. So we had first and third and second and fourth Fridays with Eli Lilly and Company. And I had the hall rented then, and they rented my hall, hired my band, and hired me to call it. And then Allison General Motors, they decided they would have a Thursday night program. So we started the same thing with them. But that was roughly what it was. And why was it so large? Well, I think because we built on the fact that we could have new people come in every night and take care of them, at least through the first few tips.
Right.
And got them, and I still, for several years, only called single couple progression dances, and then about all you had to add was a lady's chain, and we could do Hurry, 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 and we mm-hmm. could do My Pretty Girl, and still do dances like Rosa Santatone and Red River Valley, which was my theme for, gosh, they wouldn't let me stop calling Red River Valley when we were doing Teacup Chain, which was much later.
Right.
But anyway, we had that, and then I taught classes. I taught, and during this 7 years, I never had a class of under 15 squares.
Mm-hmm.
No, and we only taught lessons for 4 weeks.
Uh-huh.
4 weeks, and that got them all they needed to know.
Yeah.
And then we'd have so many people when you had 15 squares, there wasn't room for them to add them to the other programs. So I started a club on Tuesday night that I called Grand Squares and put the next class in with that. And the next class, I started another club on Monday night. Mm-hmm. And to where we were going six nights a week, the minister who I rented the hall from, minister's son, would not allow me to do it on Sunday night, and I was just as well off. So we had a six-night-a-week program going, working to capacity of people, and I thought, I'm just going to have to give up teaching. Oh, by the way, in 1950, I became chief naturalist for the United States Park System.
Okay.
So it was my job to hire and fire and go around, and I had to train naturalists all over the state to call square dances, to lead it. Song Fest,
right.
The best way to do nature lectures and park lectures and all that.
Yeah.
So I did that from 50 to 54. And at the same time, I was running the dance hall.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was teaching school. And I finally decided, I just can't do all this.
Right.
So I'll stick with the one that pays me the most money. So I'll operate the hall. Well, that summer, after I'd given up teaching, and I'd gotten involved in trying to get some programs set up, that, and I built a house on the south side near the hall. The hall burned down.
Yeah.
It was an all wooden frame, beautiful big thing. The bottom floor was all a dressing room for this swimming pool and all that kind of thing, privately owned.
Right.
And there I was, high and dry. And no money, because I had every penny invested in the house. So we found another hall to rent that didn't have the personality.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that I can only say it had a barroom atmosphere with none of the barroom things, and the people just loved it.
Yeah.
So that left me high and dry, and about all I could do was operate this hall. And you know, when you change halls, you lose 40% of your people, which we easily did. And the same thing with Eli Lilly's and Allison's. Their program just didn't go as well because they, the other part of town, and they didn't like the travel. So I used the other hall again for 10 years. And it was just a slow dwindling. And so what I started doing was I'd take a four-day period of time and eliminate my things on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, or Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and fly out and do a 3 days in New England or 4 days in New England to fly back and do my program.
Yeah.
And only once a year did I do a longer trip. That was always the 10-day trip that I did to California, in which I went Kansas City, Tucson, Phoenix, and then California towns. And so that was basically my program. So I was running the hall, not doing as well, and having to supplement it on the road. And back then, we weren't paid very well on the road.
Mm.
But after 17 years of operating this hall and doing that kind of thing, I decided that I had to get back where I had a little security.
Mm-hmm.
It was time to start thinking about retirement and all that, and I didn't make enough to buy the stocks like a couple other friends that you know,
mm-hmm.
and get their investments. So I went back to teaching school, and I taught for another 15 years, and then retired when school got to be a little tough.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly a...
it's a different history.
It is a different history. You're right. I'm amazed that you were not doing Ladies' Chain. But,
Ladies' Chain in Indiana... let me summarize Indiana. Indiana has a hill country in the south.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now the people who migrated into that hill country were primarily from the mountainous country of North South Carolina and down in there. And they came in with their clocking, and they came in with their circle
running sets.
Running sets.
Yeah.
That was in one little area.
Yeah.
Then across southern Indiana, but you have to get way south in Indiana, there was the cloggers. And, oh, some of them were so good.
Yeah.
And that was great. And that was down there. And that was all hoedown. And, or as I called, patter.
Sure.
And then in central Indiana, especially from Indianapolis down halfway through the state, this was an area in which if you called a square dance, a singing call, they'd, you know, I've had it said to me two or three times, that ain't square dancing.
Yeah, that's square dancing.
Yeah, and so it was all patter.
Yeah.
Very successful.
Yeah.
And I went to, I used to go to every dance I could go to. And some dances, there'd be a caller in every square. And that was fine. But you at least got the idea of what the other people were calling.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were the dances in that same area to live music. And this, everyone's heard about. The band started playing, and the callers started calling, or if there were more than one caller, and then the band decided it was long enough, and they'd stop, and you'd all stop where you were. But we had some good country bands, and we had a few country callers who could yell loud enough without losing their voice,
right,
to cover them, and then they finally did go to PA systems.
Yeah. Do you use a megaphone at all?
No, no. Megaphone wasn't good enough. It had to be too wide.
Yeah.
You know, your voice just had this. I had them all spread out in front of me. And,
yeah.
And of course, I used to lose my voice
at
the end of one night. Then I learned what I was doing. I was pressing all the calls.
Yeah.
And I was bringing them from the voice box. And I finally got so I could call two nights in a row without getting a little hoarse.
Yeah.
And then finally three, and I finally learned to breathe from the diaphragm, and then I never had the trouble. And I also bought a PA system.
Yeah.
Well, then, to finish that, in Connersville, Indiana, which is the eastern Indiana, and the only thing I can say, maybe it's closest to New England, we had typical New England-style dancing.
Yeah.
And there were some areas where there were only singing calls.
Yeah.
They were the only the Darling Nellie Gray and that kind of thing. But that was all that was in that little area. And ne'er the twain did meet between these two areas, right? Butted up against one another.
Yeah.
And then there was Fort Wayne and South Bend. And those were influenced by two callers who went to Pappy Shaw's.
Oh, yeah.
And they came back with Pappy Shaw's influence and had great programs, great programs, but that began to be the center of the square dancing, and I never saw any of the traditional dancing in that area.
Mm-hmm.
But as I went to dances, one different thing, and I think maybe I exaggerated in the past, and I'll try to come down, but as I went around in Indiana, I know I found five different things that were done when they called do-si-do.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, Pappy Shaw changed it to do paso to separate them out, but it was do-si-do, and we had do-si-do where it would be partner left and partner right and corner left and partner left.
Yeah.
And then we had the do-si-do, which I learned in the area that I had always started with the corner.
Yeah.
Corner, partner.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had they had the back-to-back do-si-do, which was really not in the area where I was at all.
Yeah.
That was in Connersville.
I see.
And up north. But I can remember there were five different do-si-dos. And, of course, I ended up doing the forehand do-si-do from a do-paso, what we call a do-paso with an extra hand turn.
Yeah.
The corner.
Yeah.
And then it all evolved. And I do have to tell you, because this should be on tape, there's a little town just south of I-70 in Indiana. I'll think of the name in a minute.
Okay.
Where I went to a dance. And we took a square from our Indianapolis group, and we were then dancing in our big hall at the very beginning of the program.
Okay, RT.
From our Indianapolis group, and we were then dancing in our big hall at the very beginning of the program.
Okay, our tape ended there, so we just flipped over, and we're talking about a little town in around Indiana.
About halfway between Indianapolis and Richmond.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll think of the name, I hope I do. And we went to this dance, and we stayed in our own square. We, you know, there was no trying to get in with these people who really knew a lot.
Yeah.
And the dancing was something, again, single couple progressing. And he calls some dances that we didn't know, but by watching one time through, two of us being callers, we picked it up pretty fast and had a good time.
Yeah.
But there was one thing. When we did the Alamein left and the right and left grand, no one could understand what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd gone through several tips. And I finally thought I figured out what he was saying. It's obvious his voice wasn't that clear. So I went up to him and I said, "Is this what you said when we did the Alamein left and right left grand?" He said, "Yes." He says, "That's the way my daddy called it, and that's the way I calls it."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "That's the way my daddy called it, and that's the way I calls it." And it was, "Adam on a ding-dong, when you come down, make that Bigfoot jar of the ground." That was Alamein left and right left ground. I think that's unique. And I don't criticize him for it at all. You know, I thought it was great. And but I went back and told the group, and they could hardly believe me, that was an experience out there.
Yeah. So, getting away from square dancing just for a second, Max, where did your wife come into this picture?
Well, Kay and I have only been married, we've been together 14 years.
Oh, okay.
And she started square dancing when she was 8 or 10.
Okay.
In Atlantic City. And her parents square dance, and they took her along.
Mm-hmm.
So she began dancing probably during the war, I don't know that, and then continued to dance and never ever stopped dancing.
Yeah.
And that was her background, starting with the traditional and then going up into the modern.
Yeah. Square dance. Well, we want to get in to talk about your RV park down in Tucson, but before we get that far, let's talk about recording. What about recordings you've made?
Well, I recorded for Windsor back when Windsor, I think, was sort of the top label.
I believe so.
The top label in the country. And recordings was always interesting. I had first been asked by a folk dance fella who put out records. And I went down and I called in Evansville. I went down really to a caller's training station down there. And I called a little bit, and he came up to me and he said, "You know, I'd like to record you." And I can remember my exact thoughts. If anyone is dumb enough to want to record me, he's so dumb I don't want to record for him. You know, I just couldn't believe it. But I did have, I think he wanted me to record Red River Valley, as I can remember, because that was a keynote thing of mine. And then Doc Allenbaugh contacted me from Los Angeles and said he wanted me to record in the Windsor label. And so each year what I would do, actually my pianist, I said, "Keep your eyes out for good tunes." And he said, "I know some good tunes that I learned when I was a kid that I think would make real great tunes." And there were also tunes that I recorded that were old Jimmy Durante tunes.
Oh.
And Jimmy Durante had interesting style, and he always had good, positive, upbeat. I don't like to do anything negative if I can do without it. And so I recorded out there and did recorded what was claimed to be a couple of them, ragtime piano and what was the other one? Well, anyway, that and I've had, as I go around, I have someone to say, I still carry those in my record box, yes, callers.
I do.
And but anyway, I didn't like recording. To me, it, I don't know, I just didn't like recording. But what I would do, Allenbaugh would record, we'd decide on a tune, or often he'd decide on a tune and send it to me and say, would you do it? And most of the time they were sort of mistakes because they didn't really fit me. But then on my 10-day tour through the West in California, I would stop in with Doc, and we'd go to the studio there and dub over and have that. And then he started sending me the tapes, and I would go to Chicago and dub in. But I didn't feel like I was that good at it. And back then, people did dance to. But I'll admit, I did have an insecure feeling about my calling. You know, I always was glad these people were dumb enough to want to dance with me.
Do you remember the name of that folk dance teacher, Fiving? The one that wanted you to record?
I think he had the folk dancer label.
Michael Herman?
No.
Okay. Because Michael Herman had the folk dancer label.
Yeah. Either folk dance or what was the other one that sounded like that?
Folk craft. Frank Kaltman.
Yep.
Okay.
That's who it was. It was Frank Kaltman.
Okay. He's the one I recorded with, and I didn't realize that you recorded with him.
No, I didn't record. He wanted to.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I turned it down. You know, I just couldn't see how I could be on a record at all, and never did.
Well, he made a lot of pretty good stuff eventually.
Yep. But, oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. One of the questions I've been asking people as I've interviewed them, what did you find appealing about calling square dance?
Oh.
What do you think is the big appeal?
I don't know. I had sung all my life.
Yeah.
And I sang in, you know, in choruses and octets, and never sang in a quartet. I always sang in something where they had two tenors and one who was good and I was dependable. But anyway, I'd always sung, and I don't know, it just made me feel very happy that all these people are having such a good time, and it just appealed to me. Oh, by the way, I'd better mention that I also recorded with Johnny Wyckoff on the Blue Star.
Oh, okay.
I sort of got sidetracked before that, and enjoyed that. And Johnny's music was good, but I never particularly enjoyed the work that I felt it took to really make a number good, and I just decided not to. Johnny would like to have recorded me more.
Uh-huh. Okay. Tell us about your involvement with Carland. I know you were on the board for a while.
Yeah, I didn't go into Carla Lab for some personal reasons right at the beginning, and I should have.
Yeah, we're just talking about Carla Lab. Had a brief interruption. Go ahead.
Yeah, and then when Carla Lab was established and I could see that I wanted to find out what it was all about, and I went to Color Lab meeting. I think the first one I went to was in Chicago, and enjoyed it immensely. And then I was teaching, and I didn't feel like I could devote any time to it. And so I went to all the Color Lab meetings at first whenever I could. It was always at our spring vacation, which was a good idea, but sometimes they changed it. Not Color Lab, but the school system.
Mm-hmm.
And then I knew that one thing I wanted to do in my life was see if I couldn't get elected to the board. I just wanted to understand how the organization worked. And I ran. Luckily, I ran once and was elected. I never could quite figure out why. But anyway, it was a marvelous experience. And you've all heard how people say that the Color Lab board is a marvelous thing, and I felt honored to be able to serve with them. And I was impressed and will never be other than impressed by what they do and their dedication.
Right.
Well, then I gave a good many programs there.
Right.
They seemed to dub me in as an after-party man, which I did several sessions on after-parties for them, then asked to do others and declined because I just didn't feel like I could get that.
Yeah.
And then they used to especially have me in teaching clinics,
mm-hmm.
which was also fun.
Yeah. What about national conventions? I know I've seen you at more than one.
Well, I went to my first national convention when it was in Houston, Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was like the third one.
That's about right.
I think it was like the third one. I went to it, had a wonderful time, again went with this other caller friend and another couple there. And we just had a wonderful time. And then I went to all the conventions for a period of time. I thoroughly enjoyed them. And then, I don't know, 10 or 12. And then I sort of drifted away. They were a little farther away. And to me, they got a little over-organized, and which is nothing wrong with that. It had to be organized, and I finally stopped. When I stopped going, I just decided I wouldn't go anymore, and so I didn't. But I thoroughly enjoyed the national conventions.
Did you go to the one in Miami?
Yes. Yeah.
If I remember, you can verify a story for me that I.
I hope you didn't hear what I'm. Go ahead.
No. You were calling in the evening, out of doors, and a couple of fellows walked up on stage. And, of course, everybody knows that once in a while, a couple of guys would come up and wrap the collar in toilet paper like a mummy. But they took this one step a little bit further, and two of them reached over and turned you upside down. And you never missed a beat, kept the call the whole darn time, and they held you right there upside down during the whole singing call. Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember that well.
Remember who did it? It seemed like it was Vaughn Parrish to me.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember
it
at all.
It really matter.
There was one other time that something like that happened, and if I remember right, it was Dave Taylor and might have been Johnny Davis. I don't know. But Dave Taylor always tells a story about what they did to me in Detroit outdoors and did something similar. But yes, that happened in Miami.
Yeah. beside the Nationals and other state festivals and like that, what other big events have you been involved in? Anything particular, anything special?
Oh, well, the Delaware Valley Festival, I can remember. Oh, the first festival I ever went to, which I remember very well, seems like it was, 1956, 1957, they had a professional staff, and I forget who they were. I know one of them was Al Brundage, and they also hired what we called a sub-staff, and that was Dick Ledger, Earl Johnston, and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked us in there, but we definitely weren't the name staff, and we called, and I remember that with such pleasure because I fell in love with Earl Johnston and Dick Ledger and
later on worth of him. Then I did the New Orleans Festival and the Memphis Festival and all across the South, Mobile, and I used to do most the Alabama Jubilee. I was sort of a fixture on the Alabama Jubilee for a good many years and thoroughly enjoyed it. And then a couple times I did the Golden State Roundup. I was always very proud of that because that certainly was one of the greatest of the festivals around. Yeah. And then I, you know, I did festivals here and there. Lots of them I can't even remember where they were. I wish I'd kept records of all that.
But I do.
But all my records that I had back then, I threw out a long time ago.
Sure. What about overseas?
Overseas, I really never called overseas other than when we took groups.
Yeah.
We've taken lots of tour groups, you know, to China and to Europe, Central America. And, we usually did about two a year, and I think we had done 14 in Tucson, and then while I was in Indianapolis, we did a couple of tours to Hawaii and a couple of tours to Mexico City and enjoyed them and called there in Hawaii.
Yeah.
But I, when I'm overseas, I just never wanted any deadlines.
Yeah.
And because I'm pretty much an outdoors person and I don't want to have to plan all of my things I find out about around square dancing. So, and I could have called in summertime various places around for the last 14 years, but I just didn't want a deadline.
Yeah.
I did go back and call in Indianapolis once, and for a group that brought in a singles group that brought in callers.
Yeah.
It was just great to see that you could come back after all these years and then really have a crowd.
Yeah.
I thought that they, you know, there'd be so many new people and they would have forgotten, but that was fun.
Well, which brings up the fact that in your naturalist's endeavors over the years, you became a bird watcher.
Well, I became a bird watcher in 1941, the first year that I worked as a naturalist. And my ear for music was good, and I just tried to see. I tried to see every bird in North America that I can. And back then, I was busy learning all the calls because that was the most fascinating thing, to be able to recognize every twitter. And up until my sound began to, my highs began disappearing out of my ears, why I was sort of a specialist in sound. But I birdwatched, I think my total number of birds north of the Rio Grande is 600 and something, and probably in the world about 22 to 2500. I don't have them all categorized yet.
Uh-huh.
I've just started putting them into the computer.
Is that right?
But birdwatching is, and then mammals, and, well, we've done all those things. We've, you know, done Antarctica and all the seven continents. And we're going to do a bird watching trip in about a month and a half to Belize and spend a week on a coral reef that I've been to before, and then a week in a great rainforest. But that's what we did. Spent a year ago Christmas in we spent last Christmas in Venezuela, down in a couple of wilderness places, and the Christmas before that we spent in Antarctica.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about when did you retire and move into Tucson area, and tell us about your RV park.
Okay. I when I was traveling, the first time I was out, I had an extra day in Tucson because I couldn't book it. That's the main reason. And I can remember driving out and driving up Mount Lemmon, and I thought, this is the desert around Tucson is just not comparable with any of the other deserts. It's just so wonderful. And as I drove up Mount Lemmon, you started at desert and ended up in high mountains, so you were going through all these life zones from here clear up to Arctic, almost Arctic. It wasn't quite that far. And then every year I planned to keep, I always did Kansas City on Sunday and Tucson on Monday and kept Tuesday off for bird watching. And at that time, I did that, 13 years, at least 10. And I decided when I retired, Tucson was the place I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Tucson with no connections or none. And the first year, the first winter I was there, I only called one dance.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to call one dance. And, it was a little hard for me to believe that they wouldn't want to try this guy. But anyway, then Singles Club asked me to call for him the next year. And the next year I started my own program by renting a hall and all that. And luckily the hall we rented was almost, you know, four blocks from where they built our hall. So it was no big problem to transfer those people from there. Anyway, this is a marvelous park. There are two great parks in Tucson. One is Voyager, and we're Rincon Country West, about the same size, and they have very complete facilities. You know, we have a classroom, we have a full post office, we have the most wonderful wood shop I've ever seen. They have everything there. We have a painting and ceramics room, we have a coffee room, we have a card room, we have a very extensive library, we have 8 pool tables in a room, we have a sewing and crafts room, we have a dark room, we have a shortwave radio room, and all that to choose from. Plus, we have a big recreation hall, which is a tile floor, and then this big dance hall that has a wooden floor. And I happened to be going to a mobile home park near there, trying to see about possibilities of having square dances there. And we looked out across the way, and I said, what are they building over there? I said, well, they're building a new RV park. I said, yeah. And I inquired who, and they said, George O'Reilly, O'Leary, was building that park. And so I went to check into it. But eventually, I talked to George out there. Well, I was just out looking at it, and he came over to talk to me. And they were having a New Year's Eve dance, in which one neat caller asked all the callers to come and spend it with him at the airbase. And we were there at the dance, and a guy came up to me and said, I hear you're going to be the new caller at Rincon Country West.
Hmm.
I said, what? I said, that's news to me. Where'd you find this room? I said, well, I was talking to George O'Leary where we had dinner, and he said you were going to be the new caller. So that's how I found out about it. But we had a Sunday night through Wednesday night program, and then half the year Thursday morning. We had a great program. We could dance 25 squares and still leave our tables set up around the outside. And I prefer tables because they're so sociable and they add to the friendly atmosphere rather than people sitting around the wall with their wife on one side and someone that they may or may not know next to them, and they just don't get visit enough. And we had a big program. We had big classes, and we were usually running 20 plus squares, and we were competing with Voyager, which they had Johnny LeClaire for a while, and then they had Ken Bauer for a while, and now they have Randy Doherty. And we were just real happy to be able to hold our head up and say that we. I think our friendly atmosphere is what really made our program great.
One other question, like before the end tape ends, do you have any regrets about your career?
Well,
anything you wish you'd done differently?
Only one slight thing. I would have loved it if I could have had 34 years of teaching experience instead of 22. It would have made about $1,000 a month more on retirement. No. I loved every bit of it. I never felt sorry that I spent a lot of time preparing. I didn't have quite the memory that lots of guys had, and I had to work a little harder at it. But no, I loved every bit of it, and I hated to quit this spring. But I'd had a little heart problems, and my wife really thought that I should slow down. And so I went with her advice and did it.
Max, I know we're just about at the end of this tape, and I want to thank you wholeheartedly for taking the time to put these thoughts down on tape. It's certainly been a very interesting conversation. If we don't run out of tape, I'd like to ask you one more question. That is, where do you think square dancing might be going today?
Well, I have a couple of distinct opinions on that as to why I think it has dwindled. One, I think the callers know too much, and they have to call it. And in other words, I think the choreography has gotten a little bit out of hand. And it's not that the people can't dance it, but I think they've eliminated all the people who really couldn't and don't want to dance that much. And so when you eliminate the bulk of the people at the bottom who don't want to dance three times a week, I think that's one of the things. But the caller always has to hold back and just because he has that little thing in his pocket, he doesn't have to call it. And the second thing that I still cannot understand is how they can possibly publish that the average dance speed is 132 beats a minute. I know some of the first recordings we had were 136, 134, 132, all of those Cliffy Stone things. I can remember how fast they were.
Right.
But we're now getting to where we have a higher age group. People, the callers, just much slow their tempo down. And I would say my usual patter tempo is 124, and occasionally as slow as 120. It's not that I'm an old man caller. I think I called better last year than I ever have in my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that seriously. But I've just found that if you really get them dancing rather than gyrating, I think it cannot be done at 132, 136 beats a minute.
Right.
And I think that's what square dancing has to, you know, we have to put the dance back into it instead of just all choreography and say that choreography was great, because all we're ending up with is that group of people that used to go out and dance advanced. And they went into their basement groups because we didn't call to them.
Right.
And now they're trying to call to them, and so they're losing 60% at the bottom.
Right.
For no other reason than they can't keep up.
Yeah. Well, I've heard it said by more than one person that a lot of people think that the dancers have gotten bored with programs, is why the interest has gone to the higher levels, and these people are saying, no, it's not the dancers, it's the callers who have gotten bored.
The dancers bored? My gosh, that's farthest from truth. The dancers who are bored, let them go into advance.
Right.
I never called advance because I felt, and this sounds egotistical, but I felt like up when I was in Indianapolis, and I was number one man there for just many years. I felt that the number one man should not call Advanced, because he would be drawing all these people into Advanced who had no business there, just because he was teaching. So I never called one word of Advanced in Indianapolis, because I felt it would be a negative to the dance program.
Right.
And they could go hunt out. These other callers did it, and did it well. And so that, I don't think the dancers are bored at all.
Right.
I think the callers know too much.
Yeah.
And they call too much. And sure, there are a few people who think.
And